The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The latest employment reports coming in strong. Markets making new highs. Bitcoin futures begin trading. And our guest today is author and economist Harry Dent from Dent Research. All this and much more on episode number 538 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there. Welcome aboard the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host of the podcast, as well as the founder and president of Horowitz & Company. We're an investment advisory shop here in sunny South Florida, where it's sunny but pretty cold today. Actually, woke up to 46 degrees this morning. 46 degrees in South Florida. I mean, it's kind of normal, I guess, for this time of year. We get that every once in a while with those blustery winds that come in as well. But it's chilly here. I'm sure if you're anywhere north of this, it's even colder. So stay inside, stay bundled up, and maybe get that fireplace going. Get that fire pit going outside. Something to keep you nice and toasty and warm. We have a good amount of things to talk about. Lots of emails this week on the idea of what to do or not to do or everything about Bitcoin. And you know what I'm talking about. It's been in the headlines everywhere. There's been constant fascination and euphoria and excitement about the whole cryptocurrency. Why not? I mean, when you see these kind of numbers running on a price basis from last week when Bitcoin was 10,000 or 11,000 over the weekend to a high of a print of 19,000 on Coinbase this week. I mean, we're talking about a pretty significant run after not only a considerable run for the last 12 months or so, but even back to the beginning. So a lot of people have gotten very interested. I think Coinbase has opened up another 500,000 accounts over the last few weeks. So that's pretty busy. And we saw some very serious action over the last week where many of the exchanges were locked down, couldn't even get in there to see what was going on. And a lot of complaints about the usability and the functionality and the ability to handle the kind of massive amount of interest that's there for trading. Now, a couple of things I will tell you. There has been a lot of questions also about the whole idea of futures. You know, what's going on with these Bitcoin futures that are coming out? And they're staggering them out. We have the CBOE coming out and CME coming out. And we have the NASDAQ. And the first trading is going to begin Sunday night at 6 o'clock. There's some things in there that trouble me a little bit. And basically, there's going to be different futures times. In other words, there is a base time where you have futures trading from, let's say, Sunday night at 6 in the extended hours through the morning. They open up in the morning in the regular session, Monday through Friday, and then we'll go to, I think, 8:30 at night or maybe 4:15 in the afternoon. And then they open up the final extended trading in the afternoon until like 8:30 on some platforms. That means there's going to be some amount of gap between when the real actual Bitcoin trades on the various exchanges, because they trade 27 hours a day, 7 days a week, and when the futures are trading. And the futures, for example, on some platforms won't be trading over the weekend on Saturdays. So they're going to close Friday night like regular futures, not open up again until Sunday night at 6 p.m., which means that there is an entire day. Now, for the most part, futures traders sometimes get a little nervous taking things over the weekend because you don't know what's going to happen over the weekend. You know, is there going to be a geopolitical event, some kind of a war breaking out? Will there be a big announcement over the weekend on Sunday nights of a merger or not? I mean, there's a lot of things that will happen inside the markets that will be very concerning for the futures traders. However, what kind of movement do you get with index futures? Maybe about 1% or so. Maybe you can see something pretty ugly. and the shorts on the other side may see a pop by 1% into Monday morning and Sunday night. Where we have this weekend, we went from, you know, somewhere around, you know, 17,000, as low as 13,000 this weekend on Bitcoin, and back up to 14,005, and moving around pretty dramatically on Saturday into Sunday. And now if you had the futures that you had a position in on Friday on the long side, you're sitting here naked. You can't do anything. You're locked out. So I do wonder what's going to happen when Fridays roll around each and every week to the price of the Bitcoin futures, because the question is going to be, does anybody want to hold this over the weekend? Now, of course, there are those opportunities to hedge out positions or maybe even arbitrage positions. You know, you buy Bitcoin long on an exchange and you sell the futures and lock in your profits potentially. But there's some discrepancies there. And really, I don't think that arbitrage has been worked out. I mean, there's going to be a lot of trial and error. I would expect, because we put a poll on Twitter, by the way, what happens when Bitcoin futures begin trading? What does that mean for Bitcoin itself? Is it going to start another leg up? Is it going to start the beginning of a crash or not do anything? And pretty much it was tied with the idea that it will start the next leg up and it will start the ultimate crash. I will tell you that there has been a lot of excitement about the fact that there is credibility being put on the currency, the cryptocurrency, due to the fact that these futures are trading. And that has been a part of the reason why recently we've seen this big run up, because there is the thought that many hedge funds, institutions, and others that really couldn't trade in Bitcoin for their accounts previously will now have the ability to trade Bitcoin in a futures account. So therefore, if you see the futures moving, it may take the, you know, because there's a lot of excitement and opportunity to do so on the long side for institutions, maybe that will take the price of Bitcoin higher. On the other hand, I've heard from several brokers, the brokerage houses themselves, not the brokers, but the brokerage houses themselves, they're very concerned that this may be a significant corrective action that will be following this. Maybe not right away, but they'll see that a lot of people that are holding Bitcoin that have no way to really hedge out their gains that they've had over the years, take a position short on the futures, and that will put significant pressure on the side of the sell, thereby taking down the price of the Bitcoin futures and possibly even the Bitcoin itself. So, you know, you can buy this usually with about a 50% margin. So you have to put only 50% of the money up to do so. So therefore, hedging can be cheaper. You only have to have half your money up to hedge out the other side of the trade. So if you have one Bitcoin, or actually two Bitcoins, you can hedge it out with one futures contract at 50%. So there's going to be some interesting play. I would think that the uptake on this in the beginning to start out, although there may be some craziness in the beginning, but generally speaking, I think they'll be testing the waters to see how this plays because it's brand new. It hasn't been tested. We created actually, you know, we have a relationship with TradeStation where we write indicators based on a variety of different algorithms and mathematical sequences that we put together. And over, if you have a TradeStation account, there's going to be a something we call Bitcoin ACE, which is based on our market profile and a swing trading algorithm that is used very effectively by traders on futures and stocks. And we're going to have it under, it just was submitted, so it should be available probably midweek, where it has actually a panel that has all the news on cryptocurrency and Bitcoins. It has three different panels on charts, and it has our indicators that are overlaid on the chart that shows you where the most buying interest is, support and resistance lines, et cetera. It's going to take a little while to get some normality in this. Again, it's brand new. So an indicator is only good as, you know, the trading history that's been there so that you can see where the levels of support and resistance. I mean, the first trade has no first trade of an existence of a contract or of a stock doesn't have any support and resistance because it's the first tick, right? You have to wait for that to fill up a little bit, whether you're on a short-term time frame, like a 1 minute or even 15 minute, 30 minute, a day, a week. It takes a while to fill up those bars. So at first you'll start seeing things like, you know, the various moving averages, for example, or Bollinger Bands, or even MACDs, they're not going to mean anything. You got to wait for some data to backfill in there. So be careful with those charts on the futures because there's nothing to go by. But there's a couple of other gotchas on there also on the futures that I've looked at and I kind of been scratching my head on a little bit. You know, there's possibly going to come out with, right now there's monthly rolling contracts. They're possibly going to come out with quarterlies, possibly weeklies, which I don't even understand how they're going to do that. Eventually may even see options. The other question has been asked to me many times in emails recently of, okay, well, if the futures in Bitcoin actually took the price of Bitcoin up, if there was some component of the idea that the price moved up significantly due to the fact that you have, you know, the excitement over the futures coming out, is there the potential that other cryptocurrencies will follow along? There'll be futures on those. And the obvious one that you can look at is Ethereum, because I think that has the most significance in terms of the number one and number two, possibly Litecoin, maybe. But I would think Ethereum is second, and that would be something to look at as well. All right, we finished with that. Let's kind of get beyond Bitcoin. We have to talk about Bitcoin because it is a financial trading device, mechanism, security-ish kind of thing that we should be talking about because it's on the mind of many people. But let's quickly segue into the economics discussion. And I'll tell you that right now, nothing has really changed. Things are pretty good. Economics around the world, we're seeing that manufacturing numbers are still very strong. Employment numbers, especially in the United States, came out this week, 4.1% unemployment rate and about 238,000 new jobs added. That was, again, a strong number, a lot in the construction area, a lot in the service area. We saw a slight tick down in the ISM numbers on the services, but still very solid numbers overall. And even though we talked about that, how these natural disasters cause a temporary setback, now we're going to get into a situation where the backside of that, which is the rebuilding process, takes place. Remember how we talked about this? A lot of people said, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, it does. Now you're seeing a lot more construction jobs in areas like Texas and Florida, people coming on the employment rolls because you need to have them for the incredible amount of repairs, rebuilding, restructuring that has to take place. So we're seeing that there is a carry forward in some of the employment numbers that look pretty good. What's going to destroy that? There could be a lot of things. You know, there's still a lot of issues out there, like the tax bill. We still don't know exactly what the details are because we haven't seen the final reconciliation of this. Maybe it's going to be 22% for the corporate tax rate. Maybe we'll have 7 rates for individuals. Maybe we'll have 5. There may be the AMT for corporations removed or not. We may see that there's 10% for repatriation tax. It may be 14%. Anyway, we've talked about this last week as well. There's really nothing to hang your hat on right now because there's a lot of things in there that can change the whole sentiment of the markets. We saw that technology shares sold off when they saw the original version of what was voted in by the Senate. And then there was some talk about, well, we left that in there by mistake. We still don't know if they're going to take it out, the part about AMT for corporations, alternative minimum tax. And that leaves us with a big question mark as to really what's going on. Is the repatriation going to be 14%? Again, that's going to hurt big multinationals and tech companies with the idea that it was a mistake and that will be brought back and there'll be a change and then we're going to bring it down lower. Well, technology rallied last week. Markets finished in the green last week. There was a little bit of question whether or not that would happen throughout the week. There was some drawdowns in markets, and then by the end of the week, it rallied back into the green, which is what we've seen time and time again, right? Any kind of drawdown in the markets creates a significant amount of opportunity, it seems, for just quickly buy in. And that happened again last week, and that was, again, the reasons were because there was a step back on the potential for some of the areas of the tax code that or tax bill that would be rectified potentially, as well as strong economics in the U.S. and around the world. Emerging markets have been having a little bit of a rough time, down about 6% or so from the top. And that was started again after the tax bill and concern that there will be this repatriation. And if there is all this money coming out of many of the markets around the world, maybe there won't be companies investing in areas that have cheaper labor. That's the theory. Plus the dollar movement. There's a few other things going on too. But there's a lot of things that are resting on this whole tax bill question. So we'll see what happens with that. I want to mention to you that as we're getting into the end of the year, it's kind of important to think about your portfolio, make sure that you took your IRA required minimum distributions if you're of that age and if you have to do so. Of course, it's something that you can't do after the fact. So whether you have an inherited IRA, you're over the age of 70 and a half for a regular or traditional IRA, you have to take that money out. In addition, it's a really good time for tax harvesting. It's a good time to look through your portfolio to figure out if there are any losses that you could take to offset any gains. Or if you have any gains that you've taken on a realized basis, even if you don't, possibly you could take some of the profits on a stock and offset it with some of the losses on another. Do that at the end of the year. Don't be lulled into just not doing anything. Be active in your portfolio at this time because you could possibly save yourself some money. Just, simply taking some losses, of course, can be offsetting to your income to a certain amount. Or if you have any carry forward losses, you could take some gains at this point this year and not pay any taxes on it. And that makes sense, especially because we're going into a time that we don't exactly know what the tax code is going to be moving forward. Think about that. There's some uncertainty there that may be first in, first out. You may have to next year start taking out the lowest or the oldest shares that you bought, which may have the lowest basis. You may want to start thinking about kind of taking some of that out and offsetting it this year. So just think about that. This is something that we do for our clients on a regular basis, particularly in our global allocations, on our rebalancing plan for Investology as well, our trading account and portfolio, the managed growth strategy, not so much because it's trading throughout the year. Now, we entered some short positions last week. We closed them quickly. We opened them up again. We have them sitting right now, probably looking to close them. Took some profits at the beginning of the week. It's a very fast market in terms of the short side right now for protection. VIX is now under 10 again. What I would say to you is that if, in fact, you think that maybe it's time to look at some other options for diversification, because things have been going so swimmingly well of late just on the long side of the equation, which most people, that's what they have their portfolios invested in. Well, we have the Investology, which is well-diversified and a very refined strategy that looks at the entire world. It's not a quick trading strategy, but it is an extremely well-diversified strategy. We really look at management and how they've been performing, look for active management as well as passive management. We use the lowest cost management and ETFs and mutual funds that are available. Active mutual funds are used in a very specific area. If you haven't checked it out, go over to investology.com. Really cool interface. You can actually design your portfolio and see how it looks after you answer about a dozen different risk tolerance questions and time horizon questions. You go through this process, it creates on the fly a portfolio that we've designed to meet the characteristics of your particular risk tolerance. And then what you can do is adjust it and create a number of different portfolios in there. So you can kind of play around in there. And then it's easy, to be honest with you. What's really cool about this is the setup of accounts, really easy. So check that out over at Investology. If you have any questions on any of the strategies that we run, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Kind of halfway down the page are all listed there. You can check out the trading strategy, global allocations, et cetera. If you want us to manage your money, that's what we're here to do. Just a little quick commercial in here. If you like what we say, you like what we talked about, you like the kind of concepts that we have, that's what it's there for. Now, on another note, I want to mention to you that, on this show, we bring guests that you may agree with, guests that you may not agree with, guests that have very positive outlooks on the markets, on stocks, on different areas, and some that have very negative looks. Well, today is going to be someone who probably is the other side of what a lot of people are talking about today, of the continuation of this market bull and all. And we're going to bring him on because I think it's important to get all sides of the equation, all the information. So let's get right to that discussion and find out what he has to say. And our guest today is Harry Dent. He's been here before. He's from Dent and the founder of Dent Research, author of many, many books. And his latest book is called Zero Hour, Turn the Greatest Political and Financial Upheaval in Modern History to Your Advantage. Harry, how are you?
Good, good.
So, listen, I read your book before. You're kind of rapid-firing some of these. The last book, The Sale of a Lifetime, which covered the whole idea of what is coming and some of the demographics and all of that. And you talked about the potential for this, this massive bursting of economic and markets in the range of 2017 to 2019. And kind of this is a little bit more a granular view, I guess we'd call it, right, of what's going to happen here. But, I have a question for you. You do a lot of cyclical and your research on the areas of demographics, economics, all sorts of things that go together and the cycles. Is it getting more difficult lately to predict the timing of all this stuff?
No, it definitely is, Andrew. I mean, since the government stepped in late 2008, early 2009, and said, oh my gosh, the next Great Depression is starting, which we had predicted decades before that, right in this 2007-2008 time frame, they're like, no, we're just not going to let it happen. We're just going to, for every $1 trillion the economy drops, we're going to print $1 trillion to cover it over. And it's been a tag team match between, the U.S. starting off and then Europe following and then Japan way ahead of us and then accelerating more. We've been handing back and off the ball. We backed off on quantitative easing the earliest, but then Europe stepped in harder. And I'm telling you, the Japanese are just printing money three times what we've ever dreamed of doing. And this is artificial. This is not going to last. And it has lasted longer than I would have thought originally. But all they've done, they have not dealt with the debt, which is higher around the world, higher in the U.S. and much higher in emerging countries and around the world than in the 2007 bubble. Real estate prices now from Manhattan to Miami and the Shanghai and the leading bubble countries are double what they were back then. We just had a bigger bubble out of all this stimulus, and we haven't cured any of the debt problems. We haven't dealt with the reality that demographic trends, just natural demographic trends in spending and productivity, are declining in most developed countries. And guess what? The U.S. is the best house in a bad neighborhood here. We've stimulated a bit less than Europe, way less than Japan. Our demographic decline goes more sideways for decades. Japan's down forever. China's down forever. Southern and Central Europe are down forever. So, one of the funniest things I see is, all the gold bugs come out and say, we're printing money, the dollar's going to collapse. No, we're the best house in a bad neighborhood on almost every measure. Yeah, we're growing at 2% with massive stimulus instead of 1% in Europe and 0% in Japan with massive stimulus. So, yeah, we're better, and we printed less money. And we are closer to the 2% inflation targets that most central banks want. And Europe and Japan just can't get there, or not for long. So we're not in a good position in the world. We've been saying for years, after this stimulus wears off, we're going to see the real depression that started in 2008 hit. And it's going to be deeper than the last downturn. Stocks are going to crash from higher levels to lower than before. Real estate, the same thing, from slightly higher levels to lower. And we're going to have to go through this shakeout in debt and deleveraging and financial asset bubbles. Bubbles cannot last forever. The Sale of a Lifetime, the last book, was primarily about what are bubbles, what do they look like, and you know what they look like? A financial orgasm. They look just like the Masters and Johnson's orgasm chart. And that's how I measure bubbles. I put them against that Masters and Johnson's chart,
And you know what? The great bull market, which was very good at the, 1942 to 68, especially in the 60s and early, in the 50s and early 60s, no, it didn't follow this exponential orgasmic chart. Every bubble today, and guess what the biggest bubble is now? Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, this week, there was one day this week, it actually went from, it keeps going up, but one day this week, and then it comes down a bit, but one day it actually spiked to right by, and some exchanges ticked 20,000 from the start of the day, like, 14,000 or 15,000, came back down a bit. But what's interesting is, here's the question about Bitcoin. What is the impetus for Bitcoin? Because some of the things that we're seeing is that a lot of players and people and investors around the world, forget about US for a second, okay? But you see things like Nigeria, Venezuela, you're seeing countries that people are looking to get their money out of are opting, they used to go to gold and things like that and alternative assets, but they're going to Bitcoin. Is that the biggest thing, or is it just this gigantic FOMO that, there's this opportunity with futures coming out and this new asset class for people to be investing in because people are hearing, what is going on with this whole Bitcoin?
Okay, the best comparison was the internet stocks in 1999. Now, the whole tech bubble, technology companies, that was the biggest bubble we've seen in our lifetime from late 94 to March of 2000. But the last stage of that bubble was driven by internet stocks, literally from late 98 to early 2000, a little over a year. They went up like 8 or 9 times in a year. I mean, that's a bubble of all bubbles. And then they crashed 93%, most of it within a year, and half of that within the first 3 months. That is a classic bubble burst. And I think that's what's happening here is that, okay, now we've had this second tech bubble, and it's been artificially, generated by, governments just printing money and zero interest rate policies. And most of the gains in stocks, frankly, have been from companies buying back their own stocks. Okay, so get this logic. Governments around the world are issuing unprecedented amounts of debt, and they're buying their own debt with money created out of thin air, quantitative easing, to keep the interest rates low, even though they're overborrowing. So that's cheating. Companies are doing the same thing. With such low interest rates on long-term debt, they can borrow it at 4% and buy back their own stocks, even though their earnings are not growing that much at a 2% economy, which is limping along. They can increase their earnings per share with leverage from buying back their own stocks with free money. So this is an artificial bubble and recovery. It's the last bubble I see happening. And the fact that Bitcoin is now doing just like the internet stocks were in the late phase of that last tech bubble that peaked in March of 2000. Well, guess what? The internet stocks peaked a month early. And I think these cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin are going to peak at extremes just a little bit early. And that's going to be the first sign. But this thing is going to go down. And when it does, the technology stocks are going to crash 80% or more. The cryptocurrency is going to crash 90% or more. And we're going to see the next Great Depression finally set in because governments can't create a something for nothing free lunch economy forever. And that's what we've lived off the last nine years. I mean, all the gains into 2007, as our research showed for many years before that, back in the 80s, we're going to come from higher productivity, higher spending and growth from the baby boom generation moving into its peak spending, which happened right on cue into late 2007. And when the economy did weaken into 2008, we've been on quantitative easing ever since. This is like taking cocaine to keep coming from down from a high. It's not going to work.
I think they call it chasing your tail. I think they call that.
Yeah.
Something like, or eating your tail or something like that. But it's interesting because I'll go with the idea that, first of all, there's Bitcoin and there's a lot of other ancillary coins out there. You know, you have these ICOs, which I don't understand why they're not regulated, by the way. It's pretty much doing an IPO, but in the form of an ICO.
Exactly. It's a cheap, unregulated IPO, which is obviously dangerous. Any idiotic company can throw out a coin, and everyday people with no sophistication will jump on it. That's not a good sign.
Right. And then I get that, and I understand how the Bitcoin valuations, or like at least there is no valuation. I understand some of the potential utility of a coin like a Bitcoin. I get that, right? I understand that. However, for the most part, most of these other coins, I don't really understand entirely. I mean, yeah, there's Ripple and there's Monero and there's a few others that some of the other countries out there are adopting and some of the financial industry may be using for certain things and all that. However, the run-up that we've seen, especially over the last, I mean, last week, it was like 10,000 Bitcoin. It's like
insanity.
It's insanity. So now I get that. Now, on the other hand, what I don't get is, let me state one other point. I also understand how there's been a lot of artificial stimulus that has gone on in a big way. I understand that interest rates are low, and that's an artificial issue as well. I also, and I've been the guy on the pounding this whole issue of stock buybacks for a long time, saying that you got to be careful because, yeah, it does, in fact, increase your EPS, and it doesn't, you know, it's financial engineering. However, we still, even if you stop all the share buybacks and we don't have a lot of growth going forward from these companies, you know, we have a lot of companies out there that have very good balance sheets. It's not like when we saw the banks get totally, screwed up due to the fact that they were loaning all this money on high leverage and 40 time deals and all this. I mean, it's a whole different situation here. I don't necessarily see the broad-based crash, let's say that. I get that housing prices are going up 22% a year, the last Case-Shiller number that came out. We saw a 22% increase in home values on the Case-Shiller 20. That seems a little bit much, but okay, I get it.
Wait a minute. Let me back up. Is that a little bit much? You know what? Housing, long-term, absolutely, like gold, correlates with inflation rates, which are 1% to 2%. You don't think 22% a year sounds freaking bubble?
I get it. No, I get it. I said that it could definitely come down. However, even if housing comes down 30% from where we are, right? So we're back a year.
How about 50%? How many people would be underwater there?
That would be a problem. But I don't understand why we're going to see this 50%. Big... Why are we going to see this big crash in all asset classes? I mean, is it just you're saying because, well, if people use their house recently, you know, and we saw this number come out very recently that I think it's 50% of all refis have been money out refis, and people are starting to use their house as like an ATM again, and they're putting it to very
which they did before, and what happened before we had a big crash.
I get that. No, I said that. So what's the cue? Where's the cue? Is it that governments are going to stop, or central banks are going to stop issuing all this, you know, quantitative easing, keeping rates artificially low? And what's the cue in all this?
Okay. The U.S. already stopped quantitative easing in late 2014. Well, Europe stepped up to make up for it, and Japan's been going off the reservation since early 2013. They tripled their quantitative easing. So around the world, it's been like this musical chairs. Okay, U.S. starts it. Well, actually, Japan started way back, but U.S. starts it, and then Europe jumps in, and Japan jumps in even harder, and then we pull back, and now Europe's talking about pulling back. This is all a fairy tale. You can't pull back. This is artificial driven, and as soon as you pull back the cocaine, people are going to come down and go into detox. That's what happens when you're on a drug like this.
Yeah, I hear
this
you.
Is a drug. This is something for nothing, and now the next something for nothing is, guess what? Donald Trump is going to cut taxes for corporations that already have the highest profits compared to GDP in any time in history, and even though they've had free money, they're not expanding their capacity and building new plants. They're buying back their own damn stocks with cheap money. Mm-hmm. This is a total artificial BS economy. And if you pull back the cocaine, people are going to go into detox and be puking and shaking. That's what happens to the economy when this finally happens. And everybody's trying to slowly, okay,
the Federal Reserve saying, okay, we're just going to slowly buy back our bonds we all bought, you know, for nothing. And in Europe saying, oh, we're going to slowly pull back. No, once you start to pull back, the whole thing comes down. You don't even have to do it that hard because the whole system is based on something for nothing. People get to buy a car at a 2% loan rate instead of a 6%. They get to buy a house with a 3.5 to 4% mortgage instead of 6 to 7%, which would be normal this time. House prices are going up. That makes people feel richer. Stock prices are going up 20-30% a year, even more than how everybody's getting something for nothing and feeling high. And what do people do when they feel high? They jump off of roofs and think they won't die. This is what people on cocaine do, or crack. They think they can jump off a roof.
I want to switch over because you mentioned Donald Trump So one of the contentions you have is that there is we're in the beginning stages, but a major backlash in the area of, or the concept of globalization. Now, way back when globalization was beginning to be something of, you know, hey, everything's going to become global. Why? Well, because if you can globalize, then what happens is if you can get into the other countries as a company and sell and do business with, et cetera, and then possibly get cheap labor from the other countries, well, I get cheap labor to make the products that I sell back to these other countries, and we try to develop these countries and they can pay more, and you know, the whole cycle goes on. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I'm going to step back a little bit, Andrew. It's the specialization of labor, countries and individual workers and individual sectors. That is the secret to economic growth. The more you globalize, the more that everybody, every country, every company, every individual can do what they do best and delegate to other people. And it's a win-win. Globalization first surged from the mid-1800s into World War I. And when we got into war, World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II, globalization retreated, and so did economic progress for 33 years. Well, we've done it since World War II. We've seen an even steeper globalization surge with jet travel and internet, which has interconnected everything more. And you know what? It has succeeded so far that it's brought different cultures around the world at face with each other. Sunnis versus Shias, red states versus blue states. And in Northern Europe versus Southern Europe, you know, Protestant versus Catholic. I mean, this is happening around the world. And so, like any cycle, and I'm a cycle guy, any cycle will go to its extreme on the upside and to start to defeat itself, just like bubbles do. And then it has to regress and consolidate and re-strategize and shake out all the excesses before you can grow again. We're at that point. In a major 100-year globalization cycle, in a 40-year generation cycle, in a 30-year commodity cycle before that, we're seeing that the point of this book, Zero Hour, is that we're coming to the point that governments can't just keep something for nothing going when all these fundamental cycles and demographics and debt and globalization and technology are all declining at the same time. Globalization's dead. Everybody's against it. You know, the Scots want to separate from the UK and the Catalans from the Spanish. And this is happening around the world. It's not just the blue state, red state thing. And I'm telling you, there is no solution to the blue state, red state split. They are so extreme at this point from recent Pew studies, which I show in this book. There is no way to have a consensus on anything because the blue people and the red people are nothing alike, and they don't view the world the same way, and they blame each other for whatever problems there are. And it's almost like we may have to split into a red and a blue America, and that's a big deal. And I also show in the book that the biggest cycle hitting, which is something I've been talking about for many years, but I haven't emphasized it until now because I haven't seen signs of it until Brexit and Trump and stuff. I mean,
we're going to have the biggest political and social revolution, bottoms up versus top down, since democracy itself in the late 1700s. And you know, when democracy and the Industrial Revolution and free market capitalism came together, and those are two actually opposite principles, like male and female, that just clicked, you know, like Harry met Sally.
Mm-hmm.
We've been booming ever since, and now we're killing that golden goose. Special interests are taking over democracy, and central banks are taking over free markets and setting interest rates and the valuation of everything else and creating bubbles artificially when they shouldn't be doing this, and they're going to get their assets kicked. They're going to get them kicked so hard, central banks will never have any credibility for decades after this thing happens, because they have created and made these bubbles better than ever. And bubbles always crash from their own extremes. And when they do, people keep telling me, oh, they'll just print more money. Oh, I'm like, okay, they printed $12 trillion in the last several years. And when that fails and we have a bigger crash, people are going to say, oh, why don't you do $100 trillion? I don't think so.
You know, it would seem to me, Harry, that as long as people are kept fed, in other words, using your discussion, as long as you keep on giving them the drug, they're happy. So in other words, as long as people are making money.
How long can drug addicts keep taking more and more of a drug
without collapsing, going into detox, dying?
There's no way out of it. There's no way that you take more and more of a drug and it ends up a happy ending. It doesn't ever happen, ever.
But we seem to be keeping on recycling. Now I've been hearing some murmurs about other countries around the world that are thinking about dropping their taxes as well now. And, you know, we have one thing after the next. And, you know, what's interesting,
another drug. It's another something for nothing.
Exactly.
Oh, we're going to give you something for nothing. We gave you free money and low interest rates and lower cost loans and all this stuff. And now we're going to lower your taxes just when we have the greatest income inequality between rich and poor in the world. And that is a sign of a major downturn happening, like in 1929. We're going to make that income inequality worth it. This tax reform bill is a crock of you know what, okay?
Yeah.
It is hidden with some little tax cuts for middle class people. But you know what they're really doing is reducing corporate tax rates, which benefit the very rich and the top executives and the entrepreneurs and all the people in the 1% and 0.01% that are getting all the gains. This is BS, and it will not create growth in the economy because companies don't need to expand capacity.
Right.
They already have. We're at 75% capacity utilization. China's probably at 50% capacity utilization with 27% condos empty in their country. And we're thinking, oh, if you cut taxes, we're going to expand capacity. We don't need it. We're slowing demographically in demand. We've got excess supply. This is not the economy that Reagan walked into in 1980-81, where we had incredible inflation, lack of supply, and we needed to stimulate our economy with lower taxes and regulations. This is the opposite. We have excess capacity around the world, and this is just going, this money for lower taxes is just going to make the rich richer and then create a greater social divide than we already have. And you know what? The Pew Research studies, though, there's a 55% and growing difference between the typical Republican Democrat, and it was just less than 20% 10 years ago. We got the beginnings of the greatest political revolution in history because people are pissed off on both sides, and there's no way to resolve it with the present rules and systems because people have been so differentiated in their benefits or disbenefits from this extreme bubble. Bubbles never can work because they take things to extremes and they make the rich richer until the point where the poor people start to cut off the heads of the kings, like in the French and American revolutions. And that's what's happening now. Trump got elected by the all-star wrestling fans. I hate to say it. Don't quote me on this. forget I said it, the dumbest freaking people in our country just elected this president.
Well, it's recorded. It's good for posterity.
Who regularly watch All-Star Wrestling and believe that it's real.
Wait a minute.
Those are the people
It's not real?
Yeah.
It's not real?
Last I heard, it's not real. When the guy comes to the guy and then and he grabs his arm, then he throws him against the rope and throws him back against him and flips him over him. Yeah, that's not real.
Okay. And the chair is being smashed on top. No, that's not real either.
They're not real. They're plastic chairs. They're, you know, made out of foam or something.
So, I mean, let's just get back to this now. So I get that. I do understand this whole political issue because there seems to be more and more. I mean, I've stayed away from any kind of political discussion with friends, family, anybody I know, because it just gets heated. You know, no matter what you say, it doesn't matter if you agree with somebody.
Win a political, you're not going to change somebody's political opinions or religious, by the way.
Right. So when is this, if everybody's buying into this whole thing and they say, I get it. And I see your cycles from your various books and all that. And again, like I said, to start this discussion, it's very difficult to time any of this. I do believe that we have a lot of excess. I believe we have a lot of excess. I am in agreement with you on that. I believe that the tax bill is not the panacea that is supposedly being, marched around by many of the people that are behind it.
I will tell you, Andrew, something right away. We are not going to get 4%, 5%, 6% growth again. Yeah. Trump is totally delusional on this. Our workforce is not growing, will not grow for decades ahead. And we finally hired back almost all the people we laid off from the Great Recession. And an increasing percentage of people are leaving the workforce naturally because they're retiring, they're aging, and they're less productive. There is no way to create 4% growth in this country again. It's not possible demographically. I said the same thing about Japan in 1989 before they collapsed, and everybody said Japan's going to take over the world and become the number one country, and the United States is, a sunset country. Economists were not just wrong about that. They were 120% wrong. They're going to be 120% wrong about China near term. And they're going to be 100% wrong about this economy being able to sustain itself and go from 2% growth to 4% growth on total something for nothing policies.
Well, I mean, one of the things I've talked about, Harry, one of the things I've talked about before, I may have mentioned this to you, is this whole equilibrium, this magical equilibrium that we have in the whole area of productivity. Because what you have is a certain point.
No. You know what productivity is? It's 0.5%. And right. It's declining. It used to be 3% to 4%. It is going to hell because old people don't become more productive any more than they become more sexy or faster or work harder or make more money after. They don't.
I know, but now you do have them being offset by a lot of technology, robotics, all sorts of things. And what happens with that is you get a natural consumer. Consumption cannibalism, if you will, because machines don't need to eat, drink, get clothes, take time off, take vacations. They don't get health insurance, all this.
And they don't need health care benefits.
Right. So that's good in a way for the companies for profitability. However, once you start peeling off enough people from the area of work, whether it's because now you have autonomous driving and the truck drivers are going to be eliminated, or whether you have all the people at Uber got those jobs and they're going to be eliminated with autonomous driving, or you have package pickers over at the Amazon place, or you have receptionists that don't need to be in place because you have all these smartphones and these smart types of smart programs that in offices where it can be routed and all that. The thing is that there's a natural equilibrium that I see that, you can keep hiring people for services and some construction and all that. That has to be kind of manual labor. But there seems to be the slide of what the ability for human beings is going to be in certain areas of business. And therefore, the economy just is a natural kind of stagnation point.
Here to me is a better understanding of that. We have seen a peak in the internet. Everybody's got internet. Everybody's got smartphones. Everybody's got broadband and can access any information. I mean, I used to have two full-time researchers supporting me. Now I have one half-time because of Google and internet. One half-time researcher. Then all I can fill him up with because now I can Google and be 80% ahead of that person and know what I want. So okay. That's the good side. But that has peaked. Everybody's got that. this stuff about Uber and all these new innovations, these are what I call consolidating innovations. They make the internet more secure, or they make taxi drivers a little more affordable and a little more responsive and a better car. But they don't create new jobs. In fact, they may even eliminate jobs at first. It's not until those new innovations move mainstream in more powerful ways. I mean, autos first started to come in the early 1900s, but they didn't really move mainstream until after World War II. And then everybody had one or two cars, and then we had the superhighways. Oh, I mean, this changed life. People moved from cities to suburbs and lived at half the cost with more land and better schools and safety for their kids. This was a revolution. The revolution starts in its early stages, and this cryptocurrencies is the beginning of something, and biotech and nanotechnologies, but they're in infant stages. They're not, you don't get the big benefits from that till it moves mainstream. So we're moving from the peak of the internet age to what I call Internet 2, which is cryptocurrencies and things making all of that more efficient, and Uber making transportation more efficient, and automated driving. But it's not increasing transportation. It's not creating a whole new
industry.
That's
my point. It's replacing.
Yeah, it's making, yeah. It's consolidating and replacing an old industry with something a little more efficient. That's not the same as computers and personal computers and internet creating a whole new industry, or automobiles and trucks and buses. And I tell you, the biggest revolution nobody saw in the early 1900s, tractors,
yeah,
totally transformed agriculture. Mm-hmm. People didn't even see that. The whole roaring 20s bubble was as much about tractors as cars, and the crash was more about farms failing from excess debt they borrowed for that tractor revolution than it was from cars and stuff. So this is the way things happen. We are seeing the twilight of the internet revolution from 1988 to 2010 on my 45-year cycle in this book. It's just killer. But it's done, and it's going to take many, many, many years for these new technologies to transform into something that actually creates whole new industries, like the internet and personal computing did. All these innovations, they're just making everything a little better, and they're eliminating probably more jobs than they're creating while they do it at first. So that's the way technologies happen. And what I tell people is, why listen to me? I have studied demographics, what people actually do, which governments don't study, economists don't have a clue of, technologies, how they innovate at first, just like in this Bitcoin thing here, or the internet in the late 90s. Yeah, you get this big bubble and burst, and everybody thinks it's over. No, it's just the launch pad. It's just the big bang for the next explosion that's going to narrow down to fewer and fewer big companies that become the next FANGs, the next, you know, Googles and Amazons and stuff. And so we're going to see that. I mean, I don't know if Bitcoin's going to be it, or Ethereum, or somebody else, but I can tell you, there's going to be some big things emerge out of this cryptocurrency thing. And I think at some point they're going to get to a scale and efficiency that they do replace central banks and creation of money at the top down level, and create money out of transactions at the bottoms up level, which is much more superior, much more efficient, and much more secure. And cryptocurrencies are much more secure than credit cards. I have to replace my credit card every 3 months now. I mean, literally,
Yep. In
the last couple of years, every 3 months, I got to change my number, change everything, change all my accounts. And I'm like, damn, can I just go back to like walking into a store and paying cash or something, or calling up on an 800 number
Yep. And
giving a credit card number and not having to have all these, answer 10 security questions and do all this stuff. The internet has succeeded in communication beyond belief from decades ago, but it is failing in financial transactions. The hackers are using
way ahead
our information to basically screw us and to make everything more difficult. So we do need a revolution, and I think cryptocurrencies are that revolution, but there's no way Bitcoin's going to replace the U.S. dollar when it's 10 times more volatile than gold.
Yeah, well, the volatility is a bit, the volatility is obviously an issue if you want to call it a currency, because you don't want to wake up one morning and you're going out to buy a car or something like that. And you're like, all right, let me take my 5 Bitcoins that I thought it was to buy a car, and now it's 7. Or now, you know, it's just not the play. But in the meantime, it does make a lot of people very rich, and it's a lot of fun to talk about, if nothing else.
It does, but people have to realize that these cryptocurrencies, they're not a currency yet. They are like, you know, they call it ICOs, initial coin offerings. They're like IPOs. They're like the stocks for these new companies, but you can issue them quickly, you know, more quickly, with less fanfare
and raise money, no regulatory bureaucracy.
Yeah. And that's why they are going to have to be regulated at some point. I mean, you got crazy stuff happening, but you have some good stuff happening. A lot of companies have been financed, and this goes back to Michael Milken, leveraged buyouts, you know, back in the 80s. He got thrown in jail for it eventually and maybe went too far, like it's going to happen here. But he financed a lot of the leading technology companies back then that would not have got financing in the normal regulated means and stuff. So all of this stuff is part of the natural evolution of technologies, demographics, and that's what we study. I don't care whether GDP is 2% or 4% today, or if it looks good or not. GDP, everything you can measure, looked great in Japan in late 89 before they collapsed. In Japan, 30 years later, is still sucking the bottom. Never will recover because they're aging. And what did we look like? You know, again, the tech revolution in early 2000. And then all those companies dropped 80, 90% and took a long time to come back. You can't look at what's happening today. You have to look at what really drives the economy. What are the fundamental trends that, not the tip of the iceberg, what's the 85% below the water that nobody sees? That's the real trend. And that will tell you approximately, like we said, again, I had late 2007 back 20, 30 years before that as a major turning point in the economy. And that happened because baby boomers spend money predictably on average, and they were due to peak by late 2007. And once they peaked in housing and everything else, well, that's why we've had so much stimulus. The governments are just trying to replace the natural demographic demand. And in 2011, the demographics peaked in Europe, and they've been struggling ever since, and Greece and everything else. And in 2010, our 45-year technology cycle, which we cover in the book, peaked. And the internet has peaked for now. And yes, there's all these innovations, but they're in tiny markets. Bitcoin is tiny. Nanotechnology is nothing. Biotech is becoming something, but it's still a niche market. It's still not affecting mainstream economy and everyday people. And it will at some point. And when people start living to be 100 or maybe even 120, that's going to change this negative demographic scenario I see for the world for a long time to come. Mm-hmm. And that will happen. That will happen. It's not going to happen in the time to save me. I'm probably going to die at 85 to 90, but kids now may die at 100 to 110. Well, literally, let's hope you last a little longer.
You sound like you're in good health.
Yeah, but I'm still going to...
We're all going to die eventually, it seems.
Biotech's not going to come in time to save me. But my nieces and nephews and my stepkids, yes, it probably will affect their lives more than any of us can see, because it could jump 20 years in the next 3 or 4 decades like it did between the 30s and 60s. Nobody saw that coming.
Yeah, I would agree that they're making a lot of progress. It does seem like a lot of the progress is coming at a faster clip. You know what I mean? It is starting to the old S curve that you put out there, and it seems to, you know, the adoption and all that. Anyway, we're going to call it right there, because we could probably go on for hours. But the book is Zero Hour by Harry Dent. Turn the greatest political and financial upheaval in modern history to your advantage. So go grab it at all fine bookstores and Amazon and wherever else it's sold. I'm sure it's all over the place. Harry, as always, a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. And you know, people can go to harrydent.com and get more information on us and get on our free newsletter so people can get to know us. I mean,
You're still doing the free newsletter. Wow. I thought you were going to do the free newsletter for a while and then maybe charge for it. You're still doing the free one, huh?
It's a free newsletter. That's awesome. Then people want to upgrade to our better newsletters, but it's a way to get to know us. Just, you know, get on our free newsletter, listen to us. And when you finally think maybe we make sense, and I'm telling you, we got something radical to say. That's why it takes a while to get it. What we're saying is not mainstream. You're not going to hear it from mainstream economists or politicians or even Warren Buffett. I think Warren Buffett's going to get his ass kicked in the next several years after having a career of starting his company right at the bottom of the 74 recession. When if you'd have thrown darts, you could have made tons of money over the last decade.
Well, let's not take anything away from him. But
yeah, he does better than throw darts.
Yeah, he's a little bit better than that.
But I'm just saying, he had timing behind him that was beyond his comprehension, and now timing's going to go against him because he's buying these highly valued companies that are high dividend payers and have done well forever, from Coca-Cola to Microsoft. And you know what? Those are the ones that go down the most in a crash because they're the highest valued. So I think Warren Buffett's going to get a big ass kicking.
We'll see. The good news is he's approaching or beyond that 85 threshold that you talked about a moment ago. So maybe he won't be around to see it. I hope he is, because it's always nice to have him, you know, talking about stuff.
He's
great attending and informational.
Dairy Queen. He'll live. If you can live off Dairy Queen this far, you're going to live.
He's going to live. So what is HarryDent.com? Is that it?
Yeah.
HarryDent.com. And of course, Zero is the book. Thanks, Harry.
Okay.
All right, buddy.
Thank you.
We'll talk. And that is going to wrap it up for this week's episode of The Disciplined Investor. Do me a favor. Tell your friends about it, will you? Get them on. Have them listening. Plug them in. Send them an email. Send them a text. Send them an Instagram. Send them a tweet. Send them something. Facebook. Do me a favor. Retweet the tweet when the show comes out. Send out an invite to your friends on Facebook. Do what you can to promote the show. It's really important, and hopefully they'll appreciate it. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again real soon.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.